was not close with Leonard Nimoy at all, and I really wasn't close with Bill Shatner, but he's the Donald Trump of Star Trek.
Welcome to the Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association. In this episode, we'll find out how working for Gene Roddenberry turned Susan Sackett humanist, discuss whether secular humanism really is the gateway drug religious conservatives insist it is, and air some disagreements over whether DS9 and Voyager were humanist shows. Gene Roddenberry was openly humanist, and his best-known creation, Star Trek, reflects his views in many ways. Our guests this week talk about how Star Trek informed their humanism and how they used the show to educate others about humanism. Susan Sackett became Roddenberry's executive assistant in the mid-1970s and a humanist shortly thereafter. She contributed the stories for two Star Trek The Next Generation episodes and worked with Roddenberry until his death. She joined us to talk about her career with Roddenberry, working with some of the Star Trek original series actors, and her career in humanism after Roddenberry's death. Scott Lohman is the former president of the Humanists of Minnesota and a self-professed serious geek. He runs Diversicon, a science fiction convention in Minnesota, and gives presentations on humanist principles using examples from Star Trek. He joins us to talk about teaching Star Trek to children at Camp Quest.
Today on the Humanist Hour, I am here with Susan Sackett. Susan was the executive assistant to the late Gene Roddenberry, who was the creator of Star Trek. She is now on the executive board of the American Humanist Association, also is vice president of the International Humanist and Ethical Union, and was president for 11 years of the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Peggy. It's good to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. It's great. We're here in the beautiful Scottsdale, Arizona. It's absolutely lovely, and I'm so thrilled to be here with you. I wanted to start by just getting a little bit of your background and your upbringing.
Well, I'm an adoptee. I was born in New York City, although I don't remember being born. We lived in Connecticut, and I grew up in Connecticut. I was there until high school, and then my parents were of retirement age then, so they moved to Florida, and I went to the University of Florida and got a degree in teaching, which I used for about 3.5 years and discovered that this was really not my calling. And since I was like about 8 years old, I had always wanted to work in the entertainment industry. I remember the little boy next door, his father was a distributor for motion pictures, and I just was so excited about anything to do with film or TV. TV was very new when I was a kid, but I just wanted to, there was like a urge to go to California. And so after I'd taught school for a while in Miami, I went to Los Angeles ostensibly to be a teacher, and I did that for about a year and decided that I really am going to follow my dream. And I went around to all the studios and TV stations, and none of them would hire me because I didn't have any background. Oh, you have a master's degree in education. You're not going to want to work for us. Finally, I ended up at NBC, and I decided not to talk about the master's degree. And they didn't give me a typing test, which was another important thing because I was flunking all the typing tests. And in those days, we're talking about the very early 1970s. If you were not a secretary, it was very hard to get your foot in the door. And so, you know, I gave them a resume and said, yes, I'm a secretary, and I type 60 words a minute, and I can take fast notes. And they said, fine, we're going to hire you. And so I got my foot in the door working for an arena show that NBC owned. It wasn't even television or film. And just moved on from there, made some contacts and whatnot. And then a very good friend of mine who worked at NBC knew that Gene Roddenberry, the creator of Star Trek, was looking for an assistant who he was between things. They rejected Star Trek. It was not renewed. He was trying to make films and whatnot, and he had finished up a couple of pilots at Warner Brothers, was working out of his house, and I got to go on an interview because his secretary didn't want to work out of the house. He wanted to be at the studio. I thought he was nuts because he could have been working for Gene Roddenberry, and of course I knew all about Star Trek, and so I went in, had the interview, and 17 years later, just before he died, I was with him that long, 17 years.
So you were familiar with Star Trek when when all that came about. Were you a fan?
I was, but I played it down. I didn't go in there, you know, screaming, "Oh, I'm a big fan of yours," and all that stuff. I just went, "Oh yeah, I think I've heard of Star Trek."
Yeah. Well, so what was that? Cool. What was that interview like when you're being interviewed by Gene Roddenberry?
Well, the strange thing is that, you know, he just talked. We just talked about things, and he took my resume and stuck it in his desk drawer, and it lived back there for the whole time that I knew him. I don't think he ever even read it. He just said that he knew that I could do, you know, the work, and from conversation. But I had an aunt who said the exact same thing that you just said. Wow, that was a real gutsy move. It's not if you're not afraid to do it, and I wasn't afraid. I wanted to do it, so it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be brave. I'm going to, you know, get my nerve up and I'm going to go do this. It was, you know, I was what, 25 or something. It was easy to do then. So I was raised in a Reformed Jewish family, and they had been more devout, but they were kind of leaning away from it, and they wanted me to have a religious upbringing. So they sent me to the local temple, and you know, I learned to speak Hebrew, and I had a confirmation, and all I cared about was the presents that I was going to be getting. It didn't mean anything to me, but, you know.
That's what all kids care about.
Oh, yeah, you know.
The presents.
I was sorry I didn't have a bat mitzvah because I would have had more presents, but that was the only thing that really appealed to me about it. I you know, I kind of went along with it, and I had a lot of friends that were of various beliefs and religions and whatnot. It never was important to me. You know, but I sort of stayed with it. I didn't really doubt it, but I found it really boring to sit there and in services. And we didn't go that often. We went, you know, for the High Holy Days, which were Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Other than that, we were not really into it. And so when I got to college, I joined Hillel because they had good trips. But I also went with the Newman Club from the Catholic group because they had great field trips too. They, you know, went to visit different towns around the University of Florida. They went to St. Augustine. They had, you know, bus trips and whatnot. So I was very ecumenical. I didn't really care. But I never really practiced any religious rituals or anything like that. And then after working with Gene Roddenberry for a while, he was friendly with Isaac Asimov. And he received a copy of Isaac's book called Asimov's Guide to the Bible. And I read this and I thought, wow, this is really interesting. And he and Gene were corresponding. And at that time, Dr. Asimov was the president of the American Humanist Association. And we're talking the late or middle 1980s right now.
Okay.
And so I started reading some of these books and I thought, gee, this is how I feel. And realized that I was very interested in humanism and the philosophy of it. I wasn't quite sure that I was ready to say, yes, I'm an atheist, mm-hmm. but I was definitely interested in the humanist values and principles. The more I researched it and got into it, the more I realized that, yes, these are the things that I find to be my kind of ideals, the things I wanted to pursue, and then I got away from religion more or less because of Gene's influence. And he would refer to the universe as the all, but it was a very nebulous kind of thing. He was agnostic. I don't think he ever used the term atheist either, but mm-hmm. he definitely was a humanist, and I think it was some of the influence of Isaac Asimov. I think you come to a realization that you are a humanist rather than then you say, now what can I be? Or, you know, what am I? I think you suddenly say, oh, these are the things that I am. And I got interested in it, began getting more literature from AHA, went to some of the conferences. I went to the one with Gene, I think it was 1990, I'm not positive.
Well, he won an award, was the Humanist of the Year year.
No, the Humanist Arts Award.
A Humanist Arts Award.
But we went to the one the year or two before that in which Ted Turner received the Humanist of the Year Award. It was held in Florida, in Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
It was back in the 80s, I think. And so we went to that one and heard some really interesting speeches. Got to meet Fred Edwards for the first time. I think James Randi was there. I mean, this was, you know, really back in the day when people were just sort of realizing who the rock stars were going to be.
The amazing James Randi. Yes. Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I got into it primarily because of Gene's, not influence, I wouldn't say, you know, he didn't push me to become a humanist or anything, but he was involved in this and had this correspondence going, and so I explored it and became very interested and continued to be. And
do you think you had any effect on his thinking?
We had long discussions about many, many things. I don't think I influenced him to be a humanist, but I think that our discussions about, you know, life, the universe, and everything were influential upon each other. I mean, he would listen to me on occasion, and of course I listened to him. His was a much greater mind, but he was willing to put up with me, I guess you could say.
So do you think he made a specific effort to put humanism or a humanistic bent into Star Trek?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I do a talk called Humanism in Star Trek, and in which we talk about things that he brought out in various episodes that you were able to get away with such thoughts if it was on another planet or something like that. His acceptance of all races, the philosophy of Idit, for example, the Vulcan philosophy of infinite combinations, infinite diversity in infinite combinations, in which diversity is celebrated rather than people being discriminating, and the universe is filled with many different flavors, and isn't it wonderful? And he was really talking about the human experience. You can't say things out loud like, you know, they had the first interracial kiss and things like that, but it was controlled by aliens and all these other things that he explored. I mean, having a black woman on the bridge in the 1960s was unheard of, and he had Lieutenant Uhura, and nobody was pointing at her going, oh, look, there's a black woman.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. In this segment, Peggy Knutson speaks with Susan Sackett about working on Star Trek.
That was the whole point of it, is that there were women on the ship, and, you know, it wasn't, if you looked at any earlier science fiction around there, it was all men that were space explorers and whatever. And he wanted a racially mixed, gender mixed crew on the ship, and had a little trouble getting it past NBC. They said that he could have a third of the crew people could be women. And so he went along with that. He figured that what he always says with a third of the women could handle all the men anyway. So
that's great. Well, I know you had a very big effect on the Star Trek: The Next Generation in the title sequence.
Oh, right.
and changing the opening remarks. I'm thrilled about that. And I recall that being very important to me, that was a huge step, and it's because of you. So tell us about that.
Yeah, I don't like to brag on it.
I think you should. You should brag on it.
Okay.
You're responsible for it.
Well, as I said, you know, Gene and I would have many long discussions, and he was always willing to listen. He was a product of the 1920s. He was born in 1921. And in his upbringing, it's kind of hard to overcome some things. And the original opening had the exploration to boldly go where no man has gone before. And, you know, that was accepted, and everybody understood that you know, it had to do with humans, but boldly go where no man has gone before. And then when we were getting ready to do Star Trek The Next Generation, and Gene decided that Patrick Stewart, who was going to play the new captain, would recite the same exact opening. And I said, Gene, this is the 1980s now. You can't just say where no man has gone before. You have to say where no one has gone before. It was the only gender-neutral term I could come up with.
It sounds better to me,
Say where no man or woman or person or, you know, what are we going to say? So I said, let's just say where no one has gone before. And so he said, reluctantly, it took him a little while to realize that, well, what's wrong with no man? I said, well, you just, you know, think of the times, think of the way we look at things now, and just let's just make it no one. And so he did.
I'm thrilled about that. I will tell you, as a feminist and as someone who is a Star Trek fan, that made a huge difference to me.
Well, I'm glad, because
a very small thing that made a huge difference to someone. So do you have a favorite episode from the original series and the Next Generation? Wow. Well, you've written a couple of episodes.
Those would be my favorites.
Those are the favorites. I was thrilled to find out that one of my favorite episodes, The Game, is one of your episodes.
Yeah, I did that with my, we did the story for it, and the script was written by one of the staff members, but they bought the story that I wrote with my writing partner at the time, Fred Bronson, who, by the way, was the person at NBC. He had been a publicist at NBC way back in the 70s. Who introduced me to Gene. So, and then Fred and I later became writing partners, and we sold a couple of stories to The Next Generation, and the other one is called Ménage à Trois.
Ménage à Trois, yeah. Yes.
And so, and we had a couple other stories that we were pitching, but you know, it was harder for me because of where I was and you know, my position on the staff to as Gene's assistant. So it couldn't look like favoritism,
right.
So it was harder for me to get something considered. You know, I had to pitch like anyone else to the writing staff and to the writers, not to Gene, but to the people that were in charge at that time. And so there were some things that we pitched that they said, oh, we're never going to do that story. And then years later, they did it. And so what can you do?
You know, that kind of happens in Hollywood.
It does. And if you
it?
Go and make a big stink about it, I mean, it wasn't like they said, let's rip off Susan and Fred. But if you make a big deal about it, you know, the old saying is you'll never work in this town again. So, but, you know, we were lucky and happy that we did get to do a few of those.
And so do you have other favorite episodes for... Well, did they have a humanistic bent, any of the ones you
Yeah, the episode that I talk about when I give my talk on humanism in Star Trek is called Who Watches the Watchers, and it was a next-gen episode
Yes.
in which Picard is mistaken for a god because he has all this, quote-unquote, seemingly magic that these primitive people who had... They were proto-Vulcans. They were supposedly... on their path to becoming, and they were being observed through a blind, and something went wrong with the electronics, and suddenly the natives who were being observed and of course didn't know about it saw the people that were, you know, up there in the starship and in the window, and they thought it was magic, and they started treating Picard like a god. And then he gives a great speech in which he says, you know, your ancestors gave up primitive deities a long time ago, and you want me to go down there and pretend to be one of those? And he said, absolutely not, I won't do that. They weren't sure how to handle these people because now they've been contaminated by the outside world, which was not supposed to happen. They were just supposed to be observing, not interfering. There's the non-interference directive again. And instead, they had been discovered, and so now what do you do? So he brings their leader, who is a woman, aboard the spaceship, the Starship Enterprise, and shows her your planet down below, and we were once very primitive like you, and you know, you used to live in caves, but now you live in huts. And she says, well, yeah, huts are better. She said, but if, you know, your great-great-great-great-grandparents would have thought huts were magic because they had never seen anything like it. Well, our science has brought us to this point, and she doesn't get it. She still thinks that, you know, they must be wonderful, and she tries to kneel down, and he goes, no, I'm not a god, I'm not a god. She goes back to the planet, and yet there are people there that won't listen to her, and he puts himself in the way, in harm's way, and allows himself to be wounded in order to show that he can bleed just like anybody else. And they go, okay, you're not a god, finally. But it took a lot of talking out of it to get them back to where they had been before they were discovered. And so the good thing about that episode that I really like is that Picard himself states the fact that it's primitive and superstitious to believe in gods. And
it's one of my favorite episodes as well, and a great humanist message.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I'm glad they continued in that vein in The Next Generation for a while.
I know where you're going. Yeah. Now, I did not watch much of, after Gene died in 1991, I did not watch much of Star Trek after that.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in the spinoffs, like Deep Space Nine, and I watched a little bit of, what's the one with Captain Janeway?
Voyager. Yes.
I watched a little of that. I didn't watch much of Enterprise either, the last series.
Do you feel like they kind of tended, after Gene died, to take on a more religious bent in some of the episodes that you watched? I felt that way.
I didn't really watch them. That's the problem.
Okay.
I just got away from it. Mm-hmm. I knew that it was not Gene's Star Trek anymore, and that they weren't going to adhere to strictly to his particular bent. From what I understand of Deep Space Nine, there was a lot of religiosity and prophets, and I couldn't get into it. I just skipped most of it.
Is that frustrating for you? I mean, don't you feel like you had a little bit of a part in bringing this baby to adulthood?
No, I think that was Gene's thing, and he always said other people are going to make it, and they're not going to do it the same way I did. So that doesn't mean I have to watch it. I just, you know, and as far as I like the new films that have come out, I'm waiting to see something a little bit more original. You know, they visited, I don't know, the first one was okay, but it wasn't really, I don't think it had the depth of the kinds of things that Gene did. The second one, I mean, they visited Khan again, and that didn't make much sense either. And so I'm waiting to see what the third film is going to be. Hopefully it'll be better, but you know, they are what they are, and they're well done for what they are, but they're not Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. And you know, they're enjoyable. Sit back, have some popcorn, watch the movie. But it's not the philosophy that Gene would have espoused, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. How about the cast members from the shows? Did you know them at all, and did they have similar beliefs to Gene?
Some did, some didn't. I knew most of the original cast members, although I wasn't there when he was making the original series. I met them, you know, afterwards when the movies
were
being made.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, we didn't get into belief systems too much. I think Leonard Nimoy was a bit mystical and had probably more, I'm not sure what his deeply held religious beliefs were, but I know he was quite into the feminine side of God, so he wrote a book about it, or poetry or something. Shatner and I had an interesting conversation a couple of years ago.
And that's William Shatner.
I'm sorry.
he played Captain Kirk from the original series.
Right, and I should have...
And Leonard Nimoy was Mr. Spock. I would guess the majority of our listeners know all this.
Yeah. So Bill Shatner was making this special, which ended up being called Chaos on the Bridge. That was not the original title, and that was not what I thought it was going to be like, but he was interviewing everybody who had ever been involved with Star Trek The Next Generation, and supposedly it was going to be a anniversary celebration, but it turned out to be more of a what was wrong with the new Star Trek and why were all the writers jumping ship. So I got an email from his assistant, would I like to be interviewed? And I said, well, I live in Arizona. Well, we can send a crew here. And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't really want a film crew coming down my street. And it's a private neighborhood, and I don't really want everybody looking. Well, we'll fly you out here. Oh, maybe. I don't know. So Bill got on the phone and talked to me for an hour. And we discussed everything, including humanism.
Really?
Yeah. And surprisingly, I said to him, I'm a lapsed Jew. And he goes, I'm a lapsed Jew. And I said, well, this is what humanism is. And I told him all about, you know, the philosophy of it. And he says, well, that sounds very interesting. I'd go along with that, too. So then they flew me out there, did the interview. He insisted I had to be in it because I'm the voice of Gene Roddenberry, and he's not here to defend himself. So they flew me out to Burbank and had someone pick us up, took us to the soundstage. And he interviewed me, and he talked a little bit about humanism, and I think some of that stayed in the final cut, so that there's a little bit about it in this, I think it's an hour-long special that he did. It was on HBO in Canada, and I believe it's online right now. You can download it, called Chaos on the Bridge. Everybody was talking about how mistreated they were by Gene Roddenberry and his lawyer, who really was a piece of work, but I won't go there. You know, they were correct in stating that he was meddling, that the lawyer was meddling, and Gene was supposedly rewriting stuff, but the lawyer, who was not a member of the Writers Guild, was getting in there and doing stuff too. And the first year was literally chaos. People were coming and going like a revolving door in our offices, and the writers were not happy.
And this is when The Next Generation was just being written.
Right, mm-hmm. Just getting off the ground. It was in the early days of it. And so he kind of, you know, found the conflict in that, decided this would be the drama that he would put into this 1 hour show that he did. But I got to get in there and say that, you know, it was difficult for Gene because there was a lot of expectations upon him for recreating Star Trek. I mean, it was Can You Catch Lightning in a Bottle twice, which is what I think Leonard Nimoy used that expression. And so, you know, there's a lot of pressure on him, and he wanted to succeed, and he wanted it to be his Star Trek. But he also wasn't feeling that well. This was 1988, and he died 3 years later. And so, you know, it was difficult for him, but it did. I thought it came off okay. Anyway, and so I was there being interviewed with Bill, and we did get into humanism. So there's a little bit of repartee between us in which we talk about humanism.
Do you keep in touch with any of the cast members?
Well, the ones that I no, not really. Oh, I see George Takei. In fact, I just saw George in New York because I had to go to a meeting in New York City for the International Humanist Group, and I went to see his play, and we had dinner and with his husband, Brad, and we just had a really great time. And
good old George Takei.
Yeah.
Don't we all follow him on Facebook?
He's wonderful.
I do.
He's wonderful. He's funny. He's got, I don't know how many millions, 5 million followers or something.
He always has something witty to say.
Yeah. He's a great guy. I really, really like him. And other than that, I'm trying to think. I don't think there's any other cast members that I was, you know, when you're working with them, there's certain ones that you like and that you see and you feel closer to than others. DeForest Kelly was always very sweet to me. Mark Leonard, you know, these people are gone now. So I was not close with Leonard Nimoy at all. And I really wasn't close with Bill Shatner, but he's the Donald Trump of Star Trek.
You need that on a slogan.
He could charm the pants off of you. I mean, he is
He's very good with words, and I mean, I had no intention of flying out to California to do this interview, and after talking with him for an hour, I couldn't wait to get on a plane and go sit with him and chat.
But how interesting to connect with him on the humanist level, which is probably completely surprising.
Well, and I'm hoping that he was sincere about it and not just, you know, doing that to soothe my ego or to get me out there or whatever. But no, he wanted to talk about it. He was interested in it. And, you know, that really surprised me. I don't think he would be Humanist of the Year, but who knows. George did receive an award from the American Humanist Association. We gave him the very first LGBT award for excellence. So, yeah. Oh, and we're giving an award this year, and it was my suggestion.
Yes.
To John DeLancey.
Fantastic. John played Q
right.
on The Next Generation, if the fans will all be familiar with him. And so he will be at the 75th anniversary in Chicago
right.
of the American Humanist Association.
Right. It's May 23rd. 6th to 30th, I think.
And I'm, you know, hopefully we'll be interviewing him for the podcast as well. We'll just have a year of Star Trek, maybe.
Sure, why not? It's the 50th anniversary too.
It is, and yeah. There's going to be a bunch of things going on for the 50th anniversary in the fall. So after Gene died, he died in '91.
Right.
What happened from there? What was your next step in your life?
I was immediately out of work, and so I needed to get some kind of income. I went to work for a travel agency for a year because I had done a lot of traveling and I'd always been interested in the field. And so a friend of mine owned a travel agency, and he took me on as outside sales, and I wasn't thrilled. I was writing people airline tickets to Fresno and things like that. So it wasn't very exciting.
You
so,
stayed in California.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Initially.
No, I stayed there because I owned a home and I, you know, I had friends and some family and my life was there. And so after about a year of that, I had some book assignments that I did because I've written a number of books about the television and film industry.
You're listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Stephanie Zavan. In this segment, Peggy Knutson speaks with Susan Sackett about working on Star Trek, and I'll talk with Scott Lohman about using Star Trek to teach kids about humanist principles.
And then in 1994... there was something called the Northridge earthquake, and I freely admit I am an earthquake phobic, I guess. I'm earthquake phobic. I do not like earthquakes. Not that anybody does, but I was really, really very unhappy after that Northridge quake. I didn't have a lot of damage, but decided that maybe it was time to leave California for someplace a little more stable, geology-wise, so I looked around, and Arizona, the Phoenix area, and the Tucson area are pretty stable. There are no fault lines running underneath either of them, and so I began looking at property. I moved out to Scottsdale, which is a suburb of Phoenix, in the fall of '94. And I've been here going on 22 years, and I love it.
And were you just writing at this time?
I was writing, so you can write from anywhere,
mm-hmm.
and that was what I did. I was writing some books. I wrote some books about television and film and whatever, and semi-retired, I guess. If you're a writer, you don't really retire. Writers never retire. You can always write, but pretty much went into retirement and had enough that I could live on and that's what I decided to do. I moved to Arizona.
And you got involved in the Humanist Society here.
One day they were having a board meeting and they didn't have anybody to take notes. And would I do that? And I said, sure. And then I
became their secretary, and then I became their vice president. And the next thing I knew, I was the president of the group.
Were you on the AHA board at that time
already? No. I wasn't on any boards. I wasn't doing anything. These things always seem to land on my lap.
It always happens that way.
Yeah, no, they contacted me, maybe 10 years later. Somebody had left the board. They needed somebody to fill the position of AHA. So I did. IHEU had a vacancy. And
that's the International Humanist Ethical Union.
Right. And Roy Speckhart, the executive director of AHA, suggested me to fill that vacancy, and I did. And then I was elected and served a 3-year term, and now I'm in my second 3-year term with them.
So this is the new chapter in your life, and I'm using a term for an author, new chapter. So what would you title your next chapter of your life if you had to come up with a title?
End run. I'm looking forward to a lot more travel. I've been traveling a lot since I joined the board of IHEU. And I've been to France and the Netherlands and Belgium and just...
Hence the international
title
of that. That's great.
Yeah, and this year we're going to Malta in May for a general assembly there. And then in the fall we're going to Scandinavia and get to do a little of that. And after my stint is up with IHU, as they call it, and I'm, no longer on that, I'll probably want to continue to travel as much as possible. And the local group here, the Humanist Society of Greater Phoenix, although I'm no longer the president, I try to get to as many of their events and help out and, give advice to the president when he asks for it.
Seems like it's a very active group.
Now we have our own Humanist Community Center.
Wow. I think that should be the goal of all of the humanist associations across the country. What a great thing. So where can people find out more about you? You have several books. You have the book Inside Trek.
Yeah.
Which talks about your experience.
InsideTrek.com.
InsideTrek.com. You can find more about you there.
Then I have a celebrant website. It is secularweddings-az, which is for Arizona.com. Secularweddingsaz.com. Anybody looking for a secular wedding in the state of Arizona? I do same-sex marriages. I do memorial services and that sort of thing. I did several of those last year. I much prefer weddings, but,
Who doesn't?
Yeah. And so that keeps me busy.
That's so great, Susan. I'm so glad I got to be here with you. Thank you for taking time out of your busy weekend, because I know you are doing a wedding.
I am.
And you're going to be leaving from here to go to the rehearsal. So uh-huh. I really appreciate you giving me some of your time.
Oh, well, it's been my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
We are happy to welcome to the show Scott Lohman, who is the former president of Humanists of Minnesota. He was the president there for about 10 years, which frankly is as long as you can be. He is also a geek. He runs Diversicon here in Minneapolis late July every year. And he also talks about and teaches about the humanism of Star Trek. And this is what we are bringing him on the show to talk about today. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Tell me a little bit, just a little bit, because I know you're a geek. Tell me a little bit about how you got into Star Trek.
It's hard to remember, but it's always attracted me. My mother started me reading on the Hardy Boys, and then she discovered the Tom Swift Jr. series, which was basically the science fiction equivalent. And then once I got there, then as far as I can tell, even though I'm barely in there, I was an original series watcher when the show first premiered.
So you're a lifer.
Pretty much.
All right. How did you end up a humanist?
Actually, it's through Star Trek. I can call myself a Roddenberry humanist. because the philosophy of the show of humans working hard as themselves, using reason and not appealing to the supernatural to find their way of solving their problems is what Star Trek did. Even though I didn't find out about it later, Roddenberry explicitly did not have a chaplain on board the Enterprise in the original series, and you know, definitely didn't have to worry about it in the later series, but he fought having that particular position on board the ship. And so with a fictional series, they didn't have any superpowers. They didn't have that. They had their reason and their ability to problem solve, basically, you know, using the scientific method as best you can to show it in a science fiction television show.
And if you're a Star Trek lifer, does that mean you're also a lifer as a humanist?
I probably came out to myself anyway when I was in my mid-teens. And basically, once I moved out of my parents' house, very rarely went to church after that, a little bit after got married, because I wasn't quite ready to be out that way. But then when I ever had a chance, I just didn't. And so, you know, have been out as an out humanist since like early 90s, when I've been involved in organized humanism once we moved here to the Twin Cities.
And what got you to be part of organized humanism?
It's interesting. They actually found me through a Star Trek convention. I know. In 91, when Star Trek VI, the last of the original cast films, premiered, the Humanists of Minnesota paid $175 for a table at that convention and were handing out copies of the interview that Gene Roddenberry had done with David Alexander in the Humanist magazine. It was basically the only thing in that magazine, as it's like a 15-page interview with Roddenberry. And then Alexander did go on to write Roddenberry's official biography. So that was one when they had him on the cover of The Humanist and I started reading that. It's like, yeah, I can get involved with this. This is the philosophy I want that appeals to me. And this is something I can get behind and start becoming involved with.
Now, you talk about Star Trek to both adults and children as well. How do those presentations differ?
Not all that much. With the kids, you can do the appeal with just, you know, the action on that. But when you start getting them involved, because the way I did it at Camp Quest was we would watch the episode and then I'd give them 10 questions to answer after it. So they didn't just get to watch, they had to work. And so I would ask, you know, serious questions on the philosophy of the show. What did they notice? What could they pick up from the themes and the morals and the meanings in the episode? But with the adults, you start pointing out how Star Trek does that across the board and just showing that there's great things that are in those episodes and sometimes how they may have snuck it past even adults because they don't always notice it. Star Trek was able to sneak a discussion about God into Saturday morning TV in the animated series.
And let's take a step back here. For anybody who doesn't know, please tell us a little bit about what Camp Quest is.
Camp Quest is basically a week-long summer camp for humanist, atheist, free-thinking, non-believing, or even at the liberal end of the religious spectrum. For kids, it's the same as, you know, like Boy Scout camp or Girl Scout camp or even the sort of church camp where you can go off to do normal camping things, canoeing, crafts, that sort of thing. But they're also getting some science teaching as well as philosophy and that sort of stuff. So they're getting basically a camp that'll teach them some of the tenets of free thought, humanism, atheism.
And how long have you been involved with Camp Quest?
I was involved with it for 10 years. I was their science fiction night. So I originally would bring out some Star Trek. There are episodes throughout the series that are just wonderful teaching episodes to use as a text to talk about from a number of the series. Great one is from Deep Space Nine, in which Sisko is dealing with trying to get the Romulans into the war, and it's dealing with the ethics of war and the morality of trying to involve somebody in it that doesn't need to. The episode's titled In the Pale Moonlight, and it's a great talk about ethics.
Now, we talked to Susan Sackett a little bit ago, and it came up in that discussion that some people think particularly DS9 and Voyager are less humanist, shall we say, than the series that Roddenberry himself oversaw. Do you feel that this is the case? I mean, do you have to work harder to find episodes that you want to speak to when you're looking at newer series?
You don't, actually, because this episode of DS9, and there's a number of others that just tackle that issue on. The interesting thing that some may look at DS9 is that they did have one of the main characters actually believed in a religion. Well, we knew that the sort of beings she believed in were just aliens that lived in the wormhole and had a totally different concept of time on that part, which didn't make them gods. It made them different. And so even though that was considered part of her character and she knew some of that, it's still, she had the belief system that her people had with that. And it gave a different way of talking about religion, because there were a number of episodes they can talk about how getting religion involved with government is dangerous. There's some great episodes of DS9 where the Kai, who's the head of the Bajoran religion, wants to be using the government to enforce her political views and her religious views.
And how about Voyager?
Voyager has a great episode in which one of the Qs wants to die, which is called Death Wish. The Q are an immortal species that are very powerful. And it's the concept of, well, what does it mean to be immortal? What does it then mean to die if you're an immortal being? And a discussion about how do you explain that, yeah, well, immortality may sound interesting to begin with, but, you know, after you've been doing it for 10 million years, what are you going to do for the next 10 million years? And so it's a discussion around that. There are some other episodes where they do a little more mix of, say, religious society and that. So it's in there. It's just not quite as stark, say, as it is in a number of episodes of the original series and Next Gen.
What are your particular favorite episodes for teaching about humanism?
Well, in there, you're looking for some of the broader episodes. A favorite one is The Chase from the Star Trek The Next Generation, in which case they play around with the fact that Star Trek has always sort of had these concept of aliens that have seeded life throughout the galaxy, and then they discover that there is a puzzle hidden in our genetics, and a scientist has been exploring that. And it's a great way to look at our human connection, even with aliens, especially since all the aliens on Star Trek sort of look like humans, pretty much, because that's what all you can cast when you're in Hollywood is humans. So they use that to talk about what is our connection between each other. So that works great. Episodes like, say, even the episode dealing with the gangsters in season 2 of the original series, they talk about the book where the people on there have, and it's the episode's a piece of the action where they use the book about the gangs of Chicago as their basis for their society. So you can talk about, well, as humans, should we base our society on books written by people long ago? Because at that point, they're having trouble. They said, we go by what the book does. Yeah, but it's not helping the garbage get picked up. So those are great episodes when you look at that sort of thing. And when you, especially a piece of the action looks just like a fun sort of make fun of the gangsters or go to the gangster planet. But when you start thinking about it, it's like, oh, people of the book. And then you can start looking at, well, do we use experience over time to govern our societies? Or do we look at the rules written for another time in another place?
And from Next Gen?
Next Gen, Susan's favorite episode of Who Watches the Watchers, is a great one of what happens when there's a society that's looking like it's moving away from religion, and then all of a sudden an accident happens with the Federation equipment, and they start thinking, well, there might be gods, because these people have powers we don't understand. Captain Picard finally just decides at the end of the episode to show him, no, we're not any more powerful than you. We just, you know, have been banging the rocks together for a lot longer than you guys have to come up with equipment. There is no, you know, mysterious being out there that you have to pay homage to or follow mysterious rules to in order to create a better society.
And when you're bringing these episodes in and making kids do homework at camp, as a former child myself, I have to register a certain amount of displeasure here. when you do that, how is that received? I mean, obviously these kids, particularly for the original series, they're 40 years away from its target audience. Does it hold up well?
It does. A number of episodes. The one that's got the most blatant message, but is still a lot of fun, is Let This Be Your Last Battlefield, in which there are two guys, one of which is black on one side of his face and white on the other. And while they're on opposite sides of their face, and to them, that is a huge problem. It's sort of a blatant thing to talk about, the stupidity of prejudice. Because as he says, well, he's black on that side and I'm white on that side. And just showing that when you get down to it, prejudice about why people are different is quite stupid. So that one goes across on any age. They would have fine just taking a look at how just blatantly obvious you can make that. Usually the kids had a great time of being able to stretch and maybe start thinking about the episodes in a different way of other than just, you know, a fun hour to pass away their time.
Let's talk about Star Trek as a gateway drug to secular humanism.
Oh, it certainly definitely has been leveled at it. And it actually is a good accusation. What Roddenberry wanted to do when he created the series was to be able to talk about things on television that they couldn't do. If you were to write a serious, you know, political discussion, talking seriously about the issues, that would be yanked at that time so fast by the censors. What they discovered that is if you took the same speech and you had it being given by two bald guys with white faces and shiny silver costumes, it went right past their heads that this was actually still the same political discussion.
For Diversicon this year, who do you have for guests?
Our guests this year are Jessica Amanda Salmonson and Naomi Kritzer, who is a local writer, and she was just nominated for a Nebula.
Thank you very much, Scott.
Thank you, Stephanie.
As always, we value your feedback on the show. Have a comment or question for today's guests? Have a suggestion for a guest you'd like us to interview? Email us at humanisthour@americanhumanist.org or call our listener feedback line at 202-618-1371. Thank you again for listening to The Humanist Hour, the official broadcast of the American Humanist Association.